Welcome to the Stabbin' Stylists podcast. I'm Randa.
And I'm Ashley.
We are just two stylists who love true crime and hair, and we're going to tell you about both.
This is a true crime podcast. These stories may be disturbing to some. Listener discretion is advised.
When his body never was found, my girl, don't lie to me. Tell me, where did you sleep last night?
Hair history.
Hair history. That's what we're supposed to
talk about. We ask for your hair history for a reason.
Yeah, so we ask because your color doesn't just go away, guys. It's in there.
It's there.
It grows off. It doesn't just fade away to nothingness. It's still in there.
And highlights never leave your hair. No. Highlights never leave your hair. No. It does not matter if it's been 4 years ago and you've colored your hair 15 times since then. There's still been removal of pigment out of your hair. It is still lightened.
So that's the reason we ask, guys. It's not to shame you about box color. It's so we know what to use on your head.
Well, and that's a good point, though, because I've had people who have came in and their hair's like as long as mine. And I'm like, okay, this all looks the same, but what's going on? No, this is all my hair. This is all natural. And then you go to lift it and realize halfway down, probably 2 years ago, you had highlights that you put a brown box color over. Mm-hmm. And now the top of your hair is white ass blonde and the bottom of your hair is orange. Marble. Yeah, and I don't know what to do with this. Yeah. So
there's not a toner that'll fix this.
Right. And so then you have to go to that darker color and you're not going to get the blonde that you wanted. If you would have let me know, I could have put something lighter on the root and darker on, or, you know, higher on the ends to get a more even lift.
You know what reacts really poorly with a perm? Sun in.
I've heard that before. Did you guys know that henna reacts to lightener? I have had that happen one time to where you go to touch the foil and the foil is literally 150 degrees and it's dripping.
Yeah, I've had lightener react because of the shampoo people use.
Mm-hmm. Pantene. I've had lightener react to like a Pantene buildup before. Yeah.
We ask you guys what you use on your hair, what your daily routine is, what you have in your hair for a reason.
Because these are chemicals.
Yeah, and we're not asking you for like a month. We're asking you for like, if your hair's past your shoulders, we need the last 5 years.
Trigger warning, this episode contains graphic crime.
This is going to be an interesting one.
Yeah. So today, I don't really know what to call this one. I don't know if I should call this the Centennial Park bombing, the Olympic Park bombing, or Eric Rudolph, because we're going to talk a lot more about like a lot more things than just those three. So I don't know if we're also going to talk about one other person besides Eric Rudolph.
Okay.
At any rate, this is Eric Rudolph / the Olympic Park / Centennial Park. They're kind of referred to like interchangeably. Centennial Park was the actual name of the park because it was the 100th Games.
Okay, yeah.
But a lot of people, like in the headlines, called it the Olympic bombing. Or the Olympic Park bombing.
See, I've always called it the Olympic Park bombing. So right. I'm glad that you like clarified that.
So, at any rate, we are going to Atlanta, Georgia, July 26, 1996. To the 100th Games of the Olympics. Hosted by the one, the only, Atlanta, Georgia. Now, interestingly enough, Atlanta had never won shit before it won the Games. It had never won an NFL title, hadn't done anything in baseball, hadn't done anything anywhere until they got the Games.
And it was a big deal.
It was a big deal. It was huge. And then, you know, we also posted the Summer Olympics up here at the Whitewater Center, which I was so bummed when that burned down.
Do you want to know a fun little like Ashley story that I'm about to share with everyone?
Tell the world.
So, you know, they made the model Okoye for like the opening ceremony of the Olympics up on the Okoye. Yes. And what they did was they had kids that would wear the shirts for each country and carry their flag in and walk them in as an ambassador. And I don't remember what country it was. I wish I could find stuff in this house somewhere. But I got to be a little ambassador and walk in one of
the... It does.
Especially he was over the Olympic village at Lee, because all the ones up at the Okoye were at Lee. Yes.
It was such a big deal that it was called the largest peacetime security operation for a public event in U.S. history.
Wow.
It was that big of a fucking deal. There were, listen to this, 30,000 security personnel, including 14,000 of those were soldiers from all branches. Not just National Guard.
Because I started saying not just National Guard. That's wild.
This cost us over $300 million in security personnel alone.
Wow. I wonder if that goes into, like, people directing traffic and everything, or that's crazy.
The training to be security personnel, including protocols for bombing, kidnapping, and hostage negotiations, and gas attack protocols.
Okay.
Because you got to think, a couple years before this Olympics, they had the World Trade Center truck bomber, and then they had... the Oklahoma City. And then I think it was either like a month or a couple weeks before the games, there was a plane that blew up off of the coast, off the East Coast, and killed everybody on board, like 250 passengers. So everybody is keyed up to make sure that this goes off without a hitch.
And some of these people won't remember pre-9/11. This was a big deal because we didn't have all of the security measures, I guess you can say, now. Mm-hmm. Back then, we didn't have all that.
Back then, going into an event, you didn't go through a metal detector.
Right.
You showed your ticket and walked in.
You could walk someone to their gate at the airport back then. Yeah, like, that was a big deal. Yeah. So I can see why they had to put so much into this, is because that's... it wasn't
this
today.
Was a big deal.
Yeah.
Right? A crowd of around 12,000 is gathered for a free concert in the Olympic Park by Mac Jack and the Heart Attack. And everybody's having a great time. This is a free concert. I believe this is day 8 of the games. Just before 1 a.m., a security guard named Richard Jewell spots an abandoned army-style backpack under a bench near one of the telecom towers that's like close to the concert.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you guys know this, but when they set up like Olympic villages, like Centennial Park or Olympic Park or whatever you want to call it, they're massive. They're huge. And back then, it wasn't like everything was on Wi-Fi. Everything had to be hardwired in and then broadcast from satellites. So they had all of these telecom towers around that were actually throwing the games out to everybody else. 96-97 was the start of the 24-hour news cycle. Keep that in mind. Jewell had seen a group of men around this bench where this backpack was under just before they were all drinking, having a good time, as people do at concerts. Yeah. And so he goes and alerts a fellow officer. This is an actual police officer. Jewell's just a security guard. And they start to look for this group of men to be like, hey, you forgot your backpack.
Right.
They find them. And all the men in the group are like, it's not my backpack. Jewell encourages the officer to radio it in. The officer was not as concerned.
Right.
Because up until there had been over 100 suspicious bags reported. And it turned out to be somebody left it. Somebody forgot it. It was benign. No problem. He does call it in anyway because, again, protocol. They've been rigid about this.
Right.
And hopefully it's benign. Worst case scenario, somebody comes, checks it, and there's
nothing.
A wallet in there.
Yeah.
They call it in and they start to clear out a 15-foot perimeter around this backpack. Bomb tech, bomb squad, whatever you want to call it, like a localized response unit. One of the guys comes in, army crawls into this backpack, peeks inside, sees wires, sees a pipe, and sees a timing device, and boogies it the fuck out of there, right?
Yeah.
So then a line of about a dozen police officers forms and starts to try to push the crowd back. The actual, like, bomb management, like the big truck guys that are going to come in with a robot, They are called at 1:08 a.m. So this is only taking 8 minutes for them to find this out. It's called in, but they're 20 minutes away. Officials are contemplating a full evac as they're pushing everybody back. The crowd is getting a little restless. No one at the park is aware of a 911 call made at 1 a.m. from a payphone at the Days Inn, two blocks down from the park. The caller states, "There's a bomb in Centennial Park. You have 30 minutes. The dispatcher needed an address for the park. She didn't have it. She had to call around to get it for 13 minutes. And then after those 13 minutes, the police are still working out whose jurisdiction this is. Is this state or is this local? At 1:20, the bomb explodes. It is a pipe bomb with nails and screws inside. One person is dead. She's a mom at the park with her 14-year-old daughter. Her name is Alice Hawthorne. Her daughter is injured, but she survives. A Turkish cameraman was running towards the blast to cover it, and he had a heart attack and died.
So
not necessarily
related,
caused
but not related.
By,
right.
But he was dead at the scene. All in all, there are 111 people injured, including 24 officers. In the morning, the Olympic officials announced that the games will go on. Who is our hero here? Mr. Richard Jewell. Jewell was a security guard at the games, found the backpack. He's 33 years old, and he lives with his mom in an apartment in Atlanta. Jewell has recently left his job at Piedmont College. And reportedly, Mr. Jewell took his job a little bit too serious. He was just, period, point blank, a security guard, like campus security.
Yeah, no position of authority.
Well, not according to Rick. Because Richard Jewell takes it upon himself to start patrolling outside of the school. And so we're talking off campus. He's trying to issue citations and tickets. The campus ends up getting a couple too many complaints about Richard. And so they put him on probation. Richard just quits. Before the college, Jewell was a deputy with the Habersham County Sheriff's Department. He's employed 5.5 years there. And it is a well-known fact that he just keeps getting in trouble because he's a terrible damn driver. His friends joke that he drove the Deathmobile because his car was so, like,
picked up.
Oh. Okay. And, like, this extended to him driving any vehicle, apparently. Now, when he's first hired at Habersham County Sheriff's Department, this man is not authorized to make arrests yet. He does. So he actually ends up being charged with impersonating a police officer for this and pleads down to a lesser charge and keeps his job. But then later, this absolute dumbass wrecks the chief's personal car. Trying to pull a prank on a fellow officer. And when he does this, he knocks out the power to the whole neighborhood.
This sounds like me trying to be funny.
Oh, yeah. Which, of course, then he's demoted.
Yeah.
And then he quits. They say, "Hey, buddy, why don't you come on in here for an interview and tell us about how you found this bomb?" And he recalls his hero role in vivid detail. He even drew a whole-ass map of the explosion site. This is also compounded because at the previous Olympic Games, the ones that had happened before Atlanta, I believe they were overseas, an officer had planted a bomb on a bus that was carrying athletes so that officer could report it and be the hero for Mr. Jewell.
Right? No, this is a victim of circumstances, right?
The FBI is obviously very aware of his willingness to help officers and his wannabe cop status. And they're like,
"Are you using this as a, I'm the hero, put me, make me, give me a badge?"
Exactly. Looking real hard at Richard Jewell right now. And they keep, and of course, he's all too happy to help. So he's going to keep talking to him as long as they won't talk to him.
Yeah.
As long as he doesn't think he's a suspect, he's Chatty Cathy.
Because he thinks he's solving their case for him, not knowing that their case is actually against him at that time.
Exactly. After this narrative comes out that he's the one that found the backpack, he's the hero, he's the guy, right? Because media's going to do what media's going to do. They're going to find these things out. Jewell is brought in for an interview with CNN. Now, as I started, we are at the start of the 24-hour news cycle.
Right.
This 3-minute interview, is he thought it would be aired one time. It was played on a loop all night long. And so he gets on. It's a 3-minute interview. He kind of downplays his role, says, I hope that we can catch whoever did this. And so then all of a sudden, the next day, Jewel cannot leave his apartment.
He went viral before going exactly. viral was a thing.
Because there's all this media presence. In his dang parking lot. You can tell how overwhelmed that poor man
yeah.
was. He was not prepared. Eventually, he does 2 more spots on CNN. And he ends up on the NBC Today Show with Katie Couric and countless news articles about him. When the president of Piedmont College sees that Richard Jewell is being touted as a hero, he writes a little letter to the FBI. In this letter, the president of Piedmont College says that Jewell has a hero complex. He's a wannabe cop, and that he's highly aggressive and badge heavy. The behavioral science unit gets a hold of Richard Jewell's interviews and starts to analyze them. And they start to kind of notice that Jewell is lining up with the profile of a lone bomber. And that this is not looking good for Mr. Jewell. So during all of this time, behavioral analysis unit is starting to look at Jewell. They're starting to gather some evidence. They want to talk to him again. At the same time, a local reporter in Atlanta gets a hold of some information from a confidential informant. And the headlines read the next day, FBI suspects hero guard may have planted bomb. So all of a sudden, the tables have turned. They also said that Jewell is the focus of the investigation and fits the profile of a lone bomber. This derails the actual investigation into Jewell because now he's tipped off. They're panicking a little bit. Meanwhile, they don't know that Jewell has no clue about any of this. He is not tipped off about this headline until his boss for the Olympic Games calls him and says, you have a problem. The FBI says, you know what? We're going to come pay him a visit. And they show up. And of course, media is every damn where. They say, Richard, why don't you come with us? And Jewell says, am I being arrested? They say, no. He says, am I a suspect? They say, you are a key witness, and we just want to talk. And so Jewell says, all right, I'll come with you. So he goes, and when they get there, they tell him that they are going to record an interview with him to use for training purposes for other first responders.
Miranda rights were a thing by this point.
They don't ever read them to him. And so, about this time, the head of the damn FBI gets wind that they've got Jewell in there in the interview, and they ain't read him his rights.
Yeah.
Right? He calls Atlanta, and he says, stop.
Because if this guy was it, you're about to fuck everything up. Like, we won't read be able to touch
right
him.
Now, right. That's what they tell him. And they go in. And they read him as Miranda's. Okay? And Jewell, all of a sudden, realizes what's happening.
That's not what I was here for.
Everything stops. And he calls his friend, who is apparently a real estate lawyer in Atlanta. And his name was Watson Bryant Jr. And Watson then gets on the phone with agents and says, are you arresting him?
Yeah.
They again say, no. They say, are you, like, do you have him on suspicion of anything? No. And so he says, all right, interview's over. My client's going home. The following media fallout is horrendous. Tom Brokaw said they probably have enough to arrest him right now. Jay Leno, on his show, said that Jewell looked an awful lot like Sean Eckert. Who's the guy who smashed Nancy Kerrigan's knee? ATL assistant district attorney Nancy fucking Grace went on to interview on Good Morning America, gave a scathing commentary on Richard Jewell, and did everything except for tell them that he was outright guilty.
Nancy!
Now, mind you, the FBI still has found 0 forensic evidence linking Jewell any of this.
Because, I mean, if you're making this sophisticated of a bomb, you have to have somewhere to make it. So
of course, they go into his tiny little apartment that he shares with his elderly mother. And they carry out boxes and boxes of stuff. They take over 30 agents are in this tiny apartment. And they take bomb dogs in there. Multiple bomb dogs in there. Found nothing. Ass-a-fucking-lutely nothing. They get a DNA warrant for Richard Jewell and his mother. Nothing. Nothing. No matches. Nothing.
Did they have, like, touch DNA on the bomb or something? I wonder what they were even comparing that to.
Well, I think it was probably, like, they probably had, I would guess that they were probably going to test, like, the straps on the backpack.
Oh, yeah, something.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If you would have worn in, your sweat would have got on there.
Yeah.
Because it's July in Georgia, so it's, like, 700 degrees.
Right.
But at any rate, they do, they take his DNA.
But nothing.
Not shit. During that time, the Olympic Games come to a close. No arrests. It is an amazing year for the Olympics. Everybody has a great time. Nobody's thinking about the bombing anymore. And in the closing ceremonies, they do have a moment of silence for all of the bombing victims. And the commissioner of the games basically says, terrorism ain't gonna stop us. We gonna have these damn games.
We're the Olympics.
We do what we want, son. Jewel's mother takes to an interview after the games have closed and everything. This is like 3 months later. And is begging the FBI to finally clear her son's name. Because he's still being harassed.
Well, and in 3 months, if they've not found anything, like,
we gotta move on.
Right.
So, on October the 26th, the FBI finally writes a letter stating that Jewel is not a suspect. They can't legally clear his name because the case is not closed. But they list him as not a suspect. Only a witness.
But, and that's one of those trial by media things. By then, the damage was done.
Well, he does file several lawsuits. Including against CNN, NBC, and Piedmont College. The one case against the original newspaper that ran the headline about him, that wasn't wrapped up until 2013. Jewel is cleared. They still don't have a suspect. Sandy Springs, Georgia happens. We're going to January 16th, 1997. So this is roughly 6 months after the Olympics. An abortion clinic is bombed. Sandy Springs is not far from Atlanta. Agents arrive to assess the scene. There's damage to the building, broken windows, busted columns, busted walls, that kind of thing. But no one is injured. People are on the road, on the parking lot, giving media interviews. First responders are working, securing the scene, all that. And all of a sudden, a second bomb goes off. This is out in the parking lot. Agents, FBI agents, are feet away. One of the FBI agents is injured in this. Now, initially, these bombs are not linked to the Olympic Park bombings because the Sandy Springs bombings are basically just dynamite. They don't really do a whole lot of comparison at first. They think maybe we're dealing with a group. But 5 weeks later, at the Other Side Lounge, the lesbian club in Atlanta, another bombing happens in which five people are injured and one person is seriously injured. Detectives on scene while they're investigating that first bomb notice a suspicious backpack on a ledge, and immediately, because of Sandy Springs bombing, they send in the robot bomb thingy. Check it. They're going to try to disarm this bomb. They really want it disarmed intact. They accidentally detonate the bomb. But nobody's hurt. They do it safely. You can detonate. But so then they gather all the parts of all these bombs together and start to analyze them as a whole piece, including the Olympic Park, and they find the common denominator. There's a steel plate that is in every single one of the bombs that has all come from the same manufacturer. And so they now know that this was made by one bomber. This is a lone person doing all of these, right?
Which had to be crazy because they don't have just, they're not just targeting, you know, the gay bar. They're not just targeting the abortion clinic. Like,
and you also are targeting the Olympics.
Yeah.
So you've got a pretty wide range of grievances here.
Yeah.
That. So now we're going to go to January 29th, 1998, roughly a year after the original Sandy Springs abortion clinic bombing. And now we are going to an abortion clinic in Birmingham, Alabama. This is the first fatal clinic bombing in U.S. history. An off-duty officer working security for the clinic is alerted to a suspicious bag by one of the nurses. There's a backpack sitting out by the front door. And so The officer goes out to look at it. As he's bending over the bag, the bomb explodes. He's dead. And then the nurse was inside watching him check this bag from the hallway. She's also injured because glass shrapnel.
Yeah.
All of a sudden. They figure out that this bomb had to be detonated by remote control because it literally waited till Officer Sanderson was bending over.
Right.
And then it exploded.
So that means
he was watching.
Where are they?
He was watching for somebody to come check that bag. A University of Alabama pre-med student sees a man walking calmly away from the explosion. He says, "Oop, that's weird." So we trail this man who gets into a gray Nissan pickup truck with a North Carolina license plate of KND1117. They run the plate, and this comes back to one Eric Robert Rudolph of Asheville, North Carolina. FBI agents immediately go to that last listed address. They take the Asheville branch and they say, "Get out there." It's an apartment complex. They talk to the manager, and the manager says, "I don't have records of an Eric Rudolph, but I used to have a Patricia Rudolph." Gives them her emergency contact number. They call it. The man picks up, identifies himself as Keith Rhodes, who is Eric Rudolph's brother-in-law. Keith agrees to meet them in a parking lot in Asheville. When he does, Keith describes Eric as a loner, anti-government, Christian extremist, anti-abortion, anti-gay. Now, the family doesn't have any contact information for Eric. He just shows up at random when he wants to, but the last time they saw him was a week prior. And Keith says he believes that Eric is in Topton, North Carolina. And so they head to Topton. On the way, they get some intel that Eric has another friend named Randy Cochran. They show up at Randy's house, and as soon as Randy answers the door, he goes, "Guess you hear about Eric, huh?" And so when agent asks, they're like, "What are you talking about?" You know, they're like, "Huh?" And Randy says, "Well, it's all over the news in here if you want to come watch." And they're like, "Yeah, I would." And so they come in, and on the TV right there is a live press conference talking about Eric Rudolph. Well, and apparently they had some intel that somebody had gotten wind of Eric being the one, and that the media was going to release it anyway. So they said, "Let's get ahead of this and just do a press conference." Agents have a nice little chat with Mr. Randy, and Randy says that he believes that Rudolph is in Murphy, North Carolina. FBI do a little digging, and they find electric in Eric Rudolph's name for a property in Murphy. They find out that a single trailer sits on this property. So they go meet up with ATF and pay it a little visit. And so this FBI agent and this ATF agent decide that they're going to come up on cover of night, which I don't know if that was a great idea or not, because IEDs, I would like to know if I'm stepping on a switchblade or not. It gets real dark out in the woods, so I can see why you would want to sneak up on somebody in that kind of
thing. Well, because to them, they're like, this is a new kind of crazy.
Right.
Like, we don't normally...
So they sneak up on this motherfucker, and they can see that all the lights in the trailer are on. The door is open, but the screen door is closed. They go around, and they're looking at all the windows, and they realize nobody's there. So then they go and toss this place. They're going in, and they're going to find whatever they want. They find several firearms, an empty rifle case. So
that means he has one of them.
Got a rifle with him. And $1,500 in $100 bills stuck on the back of this picture frame. So this man's left and hurt.
Yeah.
He didn't take his $1,500.
And that shows that he's been prepping for some time if he's hiding money behind picture frames.
Yep. Rudolph is officially on the run. Mr. Rudolph was well equipped to spend his time in the woods. He had spent some time in the 101st Airborne Division as an explosives expert before he got kicked out because he tested positive for weed on a drug test. The FBI is gathering as much information as they can on Mr. Eric Rudolph. And then his truck is found 8 days after he's on the run, abandoned in some woods by some hunters. It's often like this brush bank where it looks like he had to get up a good speed and then just go bury this thing in this brush bank. Now, in the truck, there are receipts for all kinds of supplies that he had bought. And they think that it's enough for about 6 months in the woods by himself. Thousands of agents descend on the Appalachian Mountains around Murphy and Cherokee County. And they search, and they search, and they search. Now, we live here, so we know. People out there, y'all don't know. These are some woo.
Well, and that's what I was about to say, too, is people who aren't from here that are listening don't realize that Atlanta's so close to Murphy. All those agents they had dumped in Atlanta could, very quickly you could get there. So this is I bet this was a pretty swift little process.
Thousands and thousands. Now, Mr. Rudolph did have some community support because, as we know, in the Appalachians, people love a good folk hero.
Mm-hmm.
And if they identify with anything that he stands for. And listen, some rednecks just like a good getaway. They just won't watch him run.
Mm-hmm.
That's really it. So there was, there was signs in town that said, run, Rudolph, run. There was signs that said, like, Eric Rudolph, hide and seek champion, however many days in a row. Rudolph won, FBI zero. There was a lot of that. There was a lot of shit talking on the billboards of Murphy. The search goes on for 5 years. 5 years, this boy is on the run in the woods. Now, May 31st, 2003, a rookie cop detains a man who he thinks looks a whole lot like Eric Rudolph while this man is dumpster diving out back of a grocery store. So they take him in. They send him down. This guy said, no, I ain't Eric Rudolph. I ain't Eric Rudolph, right? Calling the FBI. The FBI's like, we're on it. They're racing down, and about the time that they, you know, get into Murphy, they get a call that says he just confessed to being Eric Robert Rudolph. When they get in to interview him, this man does not look like he has been in the wilderness for 5 years. He's clean shaven. He's clean. He's got on clean clothes. He doesn't have all the grime that is associated with being out in the wilderness for 5 whole years. This man does not look like a mountain man. We still don't know who, if anyone, helped Mr. Rudolph in those 5 years. He's not giving it up. Ultimately, Rudolph pleads guilty to avoid the death penalty. He gives the locations of where he has buried extra bombs and his dynamite stash. ATF have to go deal with that. It turns out to all be so unstable that they have to blow it up in place. Rudolph is sentenced to 4 consecutive life sentences for his 2 murders and over 120 injuries.
People remember it.
Girl, when I thought, I said, Dad, do you remember the Olympic bombing? He said, shit, yeah, he's up there in Murphy. That's where they caught him. And I said, yeah, they did. He said, he started running for a good little poke there. He was out for a while. I said, yeah, 5 years. And he goes, that's how long it was. Yeah.
So that was Eric Robert Rudolph. That's a tongue twister right there.
Yeah, a little bit.
I wonder if he went by Eric Robert Rudolph or just Eric Rudolph. And I don't know why they always throw men's middle names in whenever they do like a horrible crime.
Yeah, I don't know. Like y'all been throwing Richard Jewell's middle name.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, guys.
Don't whistle in the woods at night.
Bye, y'all.